applaud Alameda County for moving forward, looking at their data and taking this step. They do have both higher case rates and higher hospitalization numbers than we have in LA County. LA County is poised to, you know, align fully with the CDC recommendation that if a county finds itself at that high community level, they go ahead and require folks to wear those masks when they're indoors.
LA County Public Health Director Barbara Ferrer last week responding to Alameda County reinstating its indoor mask mandate. Alameda, home to Oakland and Berkeley, is one of 13 California counties seeing high levels of COVID transmission right now, according to the CDC. All of those counties are in Northern and Central California. While LA is still only seeing moderate transmission, Ferrer says we are heading in the wrong direction. Cases are up around 16% compared to 2 weeks ago. And this all comes as people are celebrating graduations, about to go on summer vacations, and potentially spend more time inside in air conditioning. Joining us to talk about how we should be thinking about the pandemic now is Dr. Peter Chin Hong. He's an infectious disease expert at UC San Francisco. Welcome.
Hi, Madeline. Thanks for having me back on.
Great to have you back. All right. So why are those counties in Northern and Central California seeing such high levels of transmission?
Well, I think it's for a few reasons, but mainly the main and primary reason is that these are the counties that weren't hit hard for any other surge until now. People have stayed home. They could afford to stay home. They worked from home. They were doing all the right things. And all of a sudden, the light switch went off and everybody so scurried around and re-engaged with life zestfully. So if you didn't have a lot of protection from previous immunity, especially with these new variants, you're going to be hit hard right now. So if you look at California, it's the inverse of what we saw before. And Central Valley is at the bottom with number of new cases and the Bay Area is at the top.
Well, why is that? Because there's such a high level of vaccination in the Bay Area.
Well, the new variants that we're seeing now, the flavors of Omicron, the party of five, of as people say, BA1, mm-hmm. BA2, et cetera, they look so different in the spike proteins that the front guards, the antibodies, they are, act like they have cataracts on their eyes. But the inside guards, the bulldog, the T cells and B cells that have memory, keep people away in general from getting seriously ill. So that's why, you know, even vaccinated and boosted people are having a hard time dodging this bullet.
Okay, so LA County is still in the moderate tier, but the case rate here is pretty high. It's around 320 cases per 100,000 people. So what do you advise people should be doing right now in terms of trying to protect themselves?
Well, I think to protect yourself, you know, you carry around a mask like you carry an umbrella. You bring it out when you feel a little bit more vulnerable, particularly if you're older than 65 and unboosted, if you're immune compromised, or if you live with one of those groups of folks. Certainly if you're unvaccinated and unexposed, those would be folks that would be worried about going to the hospital. But, you know, I think that, you know, people have brought back diagnostic tests as a way to make that family reunion or graduation party just feel a little bit safer. And of course, you want to be up to date on your vaccines. In this new era of Omicron, we are seeing more vaccinated people die, but they're older than 65 and they've not gotten a single booster. So I think that's really the main point, but still more unvaccinated folks are dying in America right now.
Mm, okay. And hospitalizations are going up here in California and also in Los Angeles. At what point do you think we're going to be, if we are going to be at a situation where we will have to reimpose mask mandates everywhere and really buckle down?
Well, we're kind of at the tipping point now, Madeline. And, you know, I think, you know, we still are in a very different place from, say, 1 year ago or from the previous surges we've had. And that's because as cases go up in the community, we're seeing a lot of people happen to have COVID because they're coming in for another reason in the hospital. But there's still a lot of people with COVID in the hospital who are sick of COVID as well. I mean, to tell you, give you a scale, you know, at the peak of January, when we were kind of in dire straits with the first wave of Omicron, we had 152 patients at UCSF's four hospitals. Right now, we're around 40, but that's much higher than, say, 20 or the teens that we were a few weeks ago. I think if we see continued growth, it's going to approach that tipping point, and that means staff sick, not enough beds, et cetera. So I think that's kind of what the worry is. Personally speaking, I don't think we'll get there for the most part. And if we do get there, it'll be very temporary because we're seeing the East Coast already start to go down in terms of their own surge and their crest and their cresting right now.
Right. And California is also seeing a little bit of a dip, right? But we don't know if that's because of lagging reporting after the Memorial Day weekend. What do you think?
I think it's on the right track. I mean, certainly there may be vicissitudes because of reporting and the holiday, but we're on the right track. We're certainly not seeing exponential growth anymore, although official cases are, of course, just a fraction of the real number of cases. I think the silver lining for me is that the sewage data in many counties is starting to go down, particularly Northern California, San Jose, San Francisco, around Sacramento. So that gives me hope that what we're seeing is potentially real. And as I mentioned, the East Coast is already seeing a drop.
We're seeing some reporting that the vaccines are being tweaked to change to just a yearly treatment, right? So that you'd only get one shot a year and it would cover a lot of the variants. What can you tell us about that?
Well, I think version 2.0 of the vaccine, we hope will come out in the fall as a booster, and it will include a cocktail of variants. For example, a little bit of Omicron, maybe a little bit of Delta. They've already shown in proof of concept trials to work. But the question is, is if there's a pi or a rho or a sigma, that might not be the magic formula. So I think we would love to have that goal. And I think we may get there in a year or two of having a once yearly combined flu and COVID booster in the same shot, like Moderna's piloting, for example, and we'll kind of get back to a semblance of normal. But I think there are so many uncertainties still, but we're trying to get there to that destination.
Right. There's so much we don't know. So given that, just personally, you did speak personally, how do you protect yourself? What won't you do now?
Well, I pretty much do everything that I want. Well, not everything, but I try to be as normal as possible, but carrying around my mask with me. I bring it out when I'm in Costco for a long period of time. It's Saturday morning or it's the Sunday afternoon crowd post hike at Trader Joe's. I still dine indoors and sit at my table without a mask, but I wear the mask at check-in. I go to the gym on the treadmill. I'm not wearing a mask because my gym is pretty airy and the ceilings are high. I'm not living a zero risk life. I'm trying to just reduce my risk and get it close to low as much as possible. Being a vaccinated and boosted person, I'm not worried that I'll get to the hospital, but I just don't want an infection just because it's a drag. My coworkers have to cover me. There is a minuscule but real effect in a vaccinated person of potentially having chronic symptoms. So those are all the possible pluses and minuses.
All right. Well, thanks for coming back on the show.
My pleasure, Madeline. Thank you.
That's Dr. Peter Chin Hong, infectious disease specialist at UC San Francisco. Well, we're hearing a lot of warnings that the economy is in bad shape. The World Bank said today that most developing countries are likely headed toward recession, thanks mainly to the war in Ukraine. Last week, the CEO of JPMorgan Chase, Jamie Dimon, warned of an impending economic hurricane. Gas prices are soaring, inflation is climbing, interest rates are rising, and yet, on an individual level, most Americans say they're doing okay. Last month, the Federal Reserve released a report that asked people if they could handle a $400 emergency with spare cash. And more than two-thirds of American adults said they could. And that's the highest percentage in almost a decade. One Atlantic writer summed up the current mood this way: everything is terrible, but I'm fine. So how should we navigate these confusing economic times? Dean Baker is here to help us. He's a senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Hello.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Well, what are your general thoughts right now on the economy?
Well, I see the economy as being overwhelmingly positive. We had a jobs report for May that came out on Friday. We had 390,000 new jobs created in the month. We've had the fastest job growth really in the country's history in the last 18 months. The unemployment rate's at 3.6%. These are all really, really good things. Now, the bad news, of course, that gets highlighted everywhere is inflation, and that is a serious problem. And most immediately, the price of gas that we hear about constantly, because that is a big deal. I understand that. People need gas. They drive to work and other things, so it's a big deal. That's a big problem. But I separate that from the rest of the economy in the sense that most other things look pretty good.
But then we see the stock market going up and down and up and down, and that also makes us feel jittery about our retirement plans and our savings. So how should we think about that?
Yeah, the stock market, obviously people have their retirement money there. I'm one of those people. It's a big deal for those people, but it doesn't closely reflect the economy at all. And also what I would say is we had this huge run-up in the stock market from March of 2020, after the beginnings of the pandemic, and we had the rescue plan, and the market just soared. And of course, people had their money in the market, were very happy for that. But that really was, there was no reason to expect that sort of run up. And What we've seen is the market's given back some of that ground. So again, if you have money in the market, obviously you'd be happy if we were still back at the peaks we were at back in December, wherever the exact peak was. But that's not the way the market works.
Yeah. And so people shouldn't panic and pull their money out and put it into bonds or gold or under their bed or whatever.
If you have money in the market, you have to be prepared to see it go down. So I know people say, I need money for my kids' tuition in September, and what am I going to do? The market fell. You have to plan ahead. So if you know you're going to need whatever amount of money come September for your kids' tuition or whatever bill you might be paying, don't wait till September to sell your stock. Make sure you've cashed out some of it 6 months earlier, some of it 3 months earlier. Don't sit there expecting that the market's just going to wait for you to get your money out.
Right. Okay. What is stagflation? The World Bank said that a lot of countries might experience that. That's a word that comes from the 1970s, right?
Yeah, so this is a story where we see both rising prices, we see inflation, and we have slow economic growth. So this goes against what we're used to. The normal story is, we're having very strong economic growth and we have a problem with inflation. So you could tell that at different points. Arguably, you could tell that today because we've had very good growth, very low unemployment. When you have stagflation, you're telling a story, no, we also have bad growth, high unemployment, and inflation. I'm not anticipating that. I know there's a concern about that, but I'm not anticipating that. I mean, as I said, I think our big problem right now is oil prices. I think other than that, things look reasonably good. And of course, if we could bring about some sort of end to the war in Ukraine, and I expect Putin to throw up his hands and go, I surrender. But if you can envision a ceasefire, which hopefully we can, then I think a lot of the concerns over oil will go away, too.
Okay, one other thing that people are worried about, and that is the real estate situation. It is very expensive now to try to buy a house, very difficult for most people, if not impossible. But interest rates are going up, as we discussed, so that means prices are going down. But does one cancel out the other?
Well, they do to some extent, although I would say in general we're better off with lower house prices because part of the story of high interest rates, let's say you buy a house today and you get a mortgage at 5.2, 5.3, I haven't checked the latest rate. Two things. One, you generally have an option to get an adjustable rate mortgage at a considerably lower interest rate. Now, that does have a risk. Rates could go higher. My bet is they won't, but that does carry that risk. The other option is you can go ahead, get a 5.2, 5.3%, whatever the rate you have to pay. If interest rates go down, I think there's a good likelihood that this isn't a prediction that 6 months from now or even a year from now, but somewhere in hopefully the not too distant future, interest rates will go down. You have the opportunity to refinance. And here I give the Fed enormous credit. It was important to stop the run-up in house prices. House prices rose nationwide by more than 30% over the last 2 years. That's not sustainable. And this increase in mortgage rates just took the air right out of that. So I think that's a good thing. And again, I know people don't like to pay higher rates, but I think it was necessary to stop that run up. And they did. And that's good.
So when will a millennial be able to buy a house in Los Angeles, asking for a friend?
You know, there's a lot of longer-term trends that, interesting might not be the best word, but we're seeing this huge explosion in remote work, which I think is a fantastic thing. And what that means is that you have a lot of people, I know a lot of people can't work remotely, but a lot can. And if they have the option to, instead of buying a house in Los Angeles, they can get it in a lower cost city in some other part of the country. That's a great thing for those people. And it's also a good thing for the market in LA, because it means a lot of people that otherwise would have been taking up a lot of space in LA, they're elsewhere. So I think that in many ways might be the best hope of bringing prices down to earth in LA and some of the higher cost areas around the country.
Dean Baker, senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Coming up, we are going to talk about an oak tree that made its way from the Berlin Olympics to Los Angeles and what that signifies next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. At the 1936 Olympics in Berlin, Cornelius Johnson, a high jumper from Los Angeles, set out to improve upon his fourth place finish from the LA Olympic Games 4 years earlier.
Johnson, USA. Olympischer Rekord. Erster Johnson. Zweiter Elbritten. Dritter Körber.
Well, Johnson won the gold, a triumph for the United States and for his fellow black athletes in Nazi Germany on the eve of World War II. In addition to his gold medal, Johnson also received a potted oak tree sapling. All the gold medalists did. He brought it home and he planted it in his childhood backyard in Koreatown. 86 years later, it still stands, now a stately 50 feet tall. Behind that now dilapidated white bungalow. But the tree may soon be lost. It's in rough shape. It's sickly and in danger of being removed by developers. Tim Marengo wrote a rich and moving profile of this tree, the stories it has to tell, and the efforts to save it for the New York Times. And he's with me now. Hi.
Hi, Madeline. It's so nice to be with you today.
It's great to have you. Well, first of all, why did he receive an oak tree in the first place? Why did Germany give these out?
So it was a idea of a Berlin gardener leading up to the 1936 Olympics. He thought this would be a great thing for the host country to do for the gold medal athletes, to give them this sapling, to bring it back to their home countries and to plant it. And of course, the oak tree, and as I learned in the reporting, had this very specific symbol for Nazi Germany of strength and deep roots and superiority. So it had that context. And then, of course, it took on a whole different context when, you know, athletes like Cornelius or Jesse Owens brought them home and, you know, planted them in their communities.
Right, right, because this was at the height of Jim Crow, pre-World War II. There's this really great photo in your piece of Cornelius and the other high jumpers holding the pot with this baby oak.
Yeah.
I mean, their arms are all outstretched in the Nazi salute. So,
well, theirs is not. If you look at their stretch, their hand is tilted a little bit, and that's a different salute. That was, some believe that was a gesture of defiance. If you look around them, surrounding them, there's Germans actually holding up the actual Nazi salute.
So their hands are cupped differently.
They're yes, not exactly.
Stretched out forward.
Exactly.
Was Hitler there when Johnson won his gold medal?
No. So Hitler, this was the very first day of competition. The opening ceremonies were the previous day, and Hitler was there at the stadium. And in the morning of that day, Finnish winners and German winners of the earlier events were welcomed by Hitler. They were obviously Aryans, and they were welcomed by Hitler in his box, and he congratulated them. And then when later in the day, in the afternoon, as it was getting towards dusk, Cornelius Johnson won, and before the gold medal ceremony, he left the stadium abruptly. And historians have debated throughout the years of if that was an intentional snub or why he left, but it was interpreted as an intentional snub because he clearly didn't want to welcome you know, a Black American. And the myth that grew up over the years was that it was Hitler who personally snubbed Jesse Owens, but it was actually Johnson who was snubbed that day.
Hmm. So he comes back to the United States with his tree and he plants it in the backyard. And sadly, he died really young, 10 years later. He's just 32, of pneumonia.
Yeah, he died on a ship as a merchant marine. And I think his life coming after he came home sort of spoke to the conditions in America at the time, you know, with Jim Crow and segregation. They even though they were gold medalists, they didn't come back to like opportunities to like athletes would today. So he was first a mail carrier and then he was a merchant marine where he died on a ship at age 32.
Oh, that's tragic.
Yeah.
So what happened to the house and to the tree?
So the house stayed in the Johnson family until 1994. Multiple generations kept care of the tree, and they had the house, and the family owned some other properties in that neighborhood. Of course, when they moved in, it wasn't Koreatown yet. It's Koreatown now, and they owned it until 1994. And then I did track down, it was funny, I had most of my draft of the story together, but I was really still holding out hope to find one of Cornelius Johnson's heirs to talk to for this story. And I ended up locating his nephew, who still lives in L.A., who's sort of the keeper of the family memorabilia of Cornelius. So I sat in his garage and he pulled out all the scrapbooks and medals and all kinds of stuff and showed me that. And so then it was sold in 1994 to a Mexican family, which, you know, they kind of knew the story of the tree and they protected it and cared for it and became a part of their family, you know, offering shade in the background. The kids would play on it. The birds would come. But then they sold in 2019 when the property was sold.
And who does this family sell it to?
It was to a real estate developer who was then relisted it with plans for four luxury townhomes already drawn up. So it was marketed as an investment opportunity for someone. And the reason it came to people's attention, this was all going forward. Nobody really understood what was going on. Nobody knew or paid attention or knew about the oak tree in terms of in the city preservation community. But there was a gentleman in the neighborhood, this really nice gentleman I met named Aaron, who had lived there for a little while in the neighborhood. And he one day was walking by the house and he saw a sign for demolition. And he vaguely knew about the history of the tree. And so he saw that and he was like, I got to find out more. This doesn't sound good that this is going to be destroyed for luxury townhomes. And so he went down sort of a rabbit hole in the internet and he got linked to this German artist who had done a lot of work with the tree, made an art installation out of it. And so he contacted him and said, hey, I saw this demolition sign. You should know about this because I know you care about the tree. And that set into motion this whole process between the artist in Germany and the curator, Susan Anderson, at the California African-American Museum to try to save the tree.
Wow. So it was just because of this guy, Aaron?
So it was almost serendipitous because if he hadn't spotted that, I think it probably just would have, it possibly just could have gone forward without anybody knowing.
So the tree wasn't registered with the LA historical powers that be or anyone official? It was
not that just, I know of, not that I uncovered, no.
Okay, so now there seems to be a campaign to save the tree, but the tree is not doing so well.
Yes, now a lot has gone on. So this was kind of going on for like almost a year. The first thing was they got an arborist from the Huntington who came to inspect the tree because at first they were thinking, you know, wouldn't it be great if we could move this tree to the grounds of the African American Museum in Los Angeles and just have it there permanently? But it turned out because of neglect and a lot of the roots have been paved over by concrete, the determination by the tree experts has been that it'd be very unlikely that it would survive. And then so at the last minute, I think in the last few weeks, there's been a lot of talk and negotiations between a bunch of foundations, including, I think, the LA 84 Foundation, which arose from the 84 Olympics. Hmm. So right now there's negotiations going on to just buy the property back from the homeowner now and preserve it. And what form, we don't know. You know, we have the Olympics coming up here in Los Angeles, and it could be an amazing sort of site as a monument and also a museum perhaps, because it's not just Cornelius Johnson. What was really fascinating to me to learn, and I knew vaguely this, but the achievements of him and the 17 other African-American athletes at that Berlin Olympics and how they sort of prefigured the civil rights movement. I mean, this was pretty, you know, historically significant and really profound considering that there were still so many barriers to competition here for Black athletes.
Absolutely. So is the idea that the house would then be a museum dedicated to understanding their contribution?
Possibly. I don't know what they, I don't think they have any set plans, but they do want to preserve the house too. And perhaps with the Olympics coming up, there'll be some opportunities to sort of turn that into something that then honors that history for visitors coming to Los Angeles for the Olympics in 2028.
And how amenable is the developer to doing that?
The developer was, I called him and he was like, he was funny. He was like, when we bought this property, we had no idea about this. He seemed very sympathetic about the historical significance of it. Although he said offhandedly, you know, why do we care about something that came from the Nazis? However, he just said, I need to sell the property. So if they wrote him a check, he'd be happy to unload it. He just wants to get out from under it.
Would the developer develop around the tree and keep the tree? Is that a possibility?
I don't think that's a possibility with what they want to do because they see the value in the property as being able to put up all these townhomes, which would need to take up the entire lot. So it sounds like he's ready to sell if they can just get to a right price with the private foundations.
What's his price?
I believe the price on the property was $1.2 million. It's on Redfin.
For anyone, really, for anyone who's interested.
It's actually in escrow, so it was sold to someone who wants to develop it, so it's in escrow.
Well, is there a time crunch here, or is it just whenever the foundation comes up with the money?
No, I don't think there's a time crunch, because now there's all these delays in the process. Like, there's a stay on demolition, so the tree has a stay, and I think the utmost concern right now is to do what they can to care for the tree, because it's been pretty neglected for some time now.
Is there any danger the tree might die?
At this point, that's a great question. I don't think so. I think in its current place, I think it's safe. This real concern seemed to be if they tried to move it. But I do think if it continues to be neglected the way it has, there would be concerns about that.
Yeah. Well, Tim, thank you so much.
Thank you for your interest. I really was delighted to do this story. I thought it was a fascinating chapter of untold history.
Well, thank you for bringing it to our attention. A really lovely story. Tim Marengo from the New York Times, where you can read his profile of the efforts to save that nearly 90-year-old Olympic oak tree. Coming up, the shakeup on daytime television.
I feel as though Ellen decided to bow out gracefully before Warner Brothers decided to make her bow out gracefully.
How working from home is turning daytime TV into a different place. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Tuesday, so that means it's time for TV on the radio.
The crown has landed on my head.
Yes, queen, yes.
You're not a killer.
This is the way.
You have to be a killer.
There was an offer before me.
If you're trying to curse, you can't.
That's bullshit.
We have so many disasters bombarding us right now.
Well, we're going to talk about daytime TV. And when you turn it on this fall, it's going to look a lot different. Ellen DeGeneres wrapped her last show at the end of May.
Welcome to our very last show. I walked out here 19 years ago and I said that this is the start of a relationship. And today is not the end of a relationship. It's more of a little break. It's you can see other talk shows now. And I may see another audience once in a while.
Also retiring soon, the man who made this phrase famous.
You are not the
You are not the father. That's right. Maury will air his final episode in September after more than 30 years on the air, although there will still be reruns. Also leaving, Nick Cannon, Wendy Williams, the women from The Real, and among the new faces you'll see, actress and singer Jennifer Hudson. Joining us to talk about all of this is Jillian Bowe. She is senior editor of DaytimeConfidential.com. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, well, let's talk about Maury. Would you call him the king of trashy daytime TV?
I would say that would be Jerry Springer. I would say that Maury is more so kind of like the elder statesman of it.
That's funny that there would be an elder statesman of that kind of TV. So why is he retiring? Is it just because he's done it for so long?
Yeah, he didn't really give a reason. He just said that he told the producers and the distributors of the show that 2 years prior that he was done, that he was going to hang it up. It's been about 30 years, so he wanted to retire.
He's 83, so he should retire.
Yeah.
Enjoy his life a little. Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you think of him as his role in all of this? What was his influence?
Maury had a huge influence. I mean, Maury has a journalistic background, but it was more tabloid. And, you know, as the years progressed, Maury found his niche, which was paternities and polygraphs and so forth. And he really established himself in the pop culture lexicon. I mean, you know, it really did shock a lot of people that Maury decided to retire because, you know, if you look on blog sites and Instagram blogs and publications for pop culture, whenever there was some drama or scandal, you would see Maury's social media crew jumping in on Twitter or Instagram saying, hey, you know, if it was something about paternities, they would say something like, oh, you know, we know something about paternities. Why don't you call this a call? And so when the news came out, everybody on social media was taken aback by it because Maury was like a staple. You know, talk shows come and go, as we see, but Maury was always there. He was right there and something that you could look forward to tuning into if you were off and there was something that you wanted to watch, just some mindless drivel. There was Maury with some paternity scandal or some lie detector test.
Everything must come to an end sooner or later. And speaking of, let's talk about Ellen's final show. Here's a clip. She had Jennifer Aniston on as her final show guest.
You know, you've been on 20 times. You were my first guest, and it was a big deal to get you. It was a huge deal to get, you know, you on my first show.
20 times, and you've been on here 19.
So one time more than once a year.
That's, you're welcome.
Okay, so 19 years. That's not usually a year in which you would retire, right? Wouldn't you have a nice even number? But she had been under a lot of criticism in recent times, right? Former employees accused her of fostering a toxic work environment. There were some employees who were accused of harassment, senior employees, and some former guests also complained. So was she pushed out or did she quit?
Well, she says that she was ready to leave. It was kind of an odd number, so to speak, for her to leave at. Usually people like Maury left at his 30 years. Oprah was 25. You use a round number. 19, you were just one off from the 20th. I feel as though Ellen decided to bow out gracefully before Warner Brothers decided to make her bow out gracefully.
Well, were her ratings off?
Ellen's ratings were still consistent. They weren't like how they used to be back when she first started. She still was at the top of her game. So, you know, you decide if she decided that she was just done with it, or did she just decide to be done with it before she was told, you know, we got to have a little talk.
Yeah. Replacing her is Kelly Clarkson, former American Idol winner. And her show is pretty popular, right? She's kind of got it. She's got that daytime talk show host thing.
Yes.
Well, do you think that she could replace Ellen, like get the same level of audience and respect?
I don't think she will be the same as Ellen. Like, Ellen is in that vein of the Oprahs, the Donahues, and the Barbara Walters. I don't mean journalistically wise. I mean with the top of their game and how they made their own way. I feel as though Kelly will make her own way and she will be something sort of close to Ellen, but she will just be her own entity. Do you get what I'm saying?
Right. Like she's not as groundbreaking as those other ones that you mentioned.
Right. Yeah. Right. She, you know, she has the gift for gab. She also seems to be relatable. She lets it all hang out. Ellen still seemed to be holding things back and always had that nice girl image. I mean, her closing is always be kind. And it's kind of ironic that she was, her whole mantra was be kind. And you heard all those allegations about her.
Mm-hmm. Of not being kind. Quite the opposite. Maybe she was talking to herself. Who knows? Well, speaking of American Idol, we mentioned in the intro that Jennifer Hudson is getting her own talk show. What is the story there?
That really came out of nowhere. Jennifer Hudson, she still has a viable movie career. She was still hot with, what was it, Respect. For her to have a talk show, that's very interesting. I mean, it could be one of those situations where everyone says you should have a talk show, but will it translate? Because we've seen a lot of people say they should have talk shows, like the Nick Cannons was supposed to, you know, Nick Cannon has that, you know, that personality, but we saw it really did not translate into ratings. So hopefully Jennifer will. This will be put up or shut up time.
Right. I mean, Harry Connick Jr., of all people, got a talk show. That seemed odd from the get-go.
Yes. I mean, he has that personality too, but it just didn't translate on camera. So we just hope that it does for Jennifer Hudson.
All right. So let's talk about talk show panels. Like, The View obviously is the queen of all of those, but there was The Real. It ended.
Yes. I feel as though The Real had a lot of upheaval. They had a lot of turnovers, so to speak. They had Tamara Mowry Housley leave. Then they also added Amanda Seals on there. Then she left. And then you added on Garcelle. There was nothing wrong with them, but they just had a lot of turnover. And then The Real lost their time slots. When Nick Cannon came to the canvas, The Real got pushed aside for Nick Cannon, and he got their slots. They put them in a really bad spot, and they just lost it all.
Another top host, Wendy Williams, she's been out on sick leave, and she was really popular for a long time. Mm-hmm. She is going to be replaced by Sherry Shepherd, also who's from The View and other shows. So can she fill those shoes?
I feel as though, just like Kelly Clarkson, that's sort of the kind of the same vein with Wendy. Nobody can really fill Wendy's shoes. And Sherry does not, she's not going to have that type of talk show. Wendy would always give you salacious and, you know, tantalizing and scandalous drama and tea on the shows. Sherry is not going to be that girl. Sherry will dabble a little bit in gossip, but she's not going to be messy as Wendy Williams is. Like, if you know Wendy from the radio, that's what you pretty much got on her daytime talk show. And Sherry's not that girl. She's a comic, so she's going to make people laugh. And Sherry also gives you that little bit of an Oprah effect, how Oprah always was vulnerable and told you things about herself. Sherry is the same. She does the same thing. Sherry does it a little bit too much.
No one has replaced Oprah. And
no,
that seems maybe impossible. But has anyone come close?
I would say no. No one's come close because Oprah gives you, she gives you a little bit of herself, and she also gets you to spill a little bit of yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, you feel like you're talking to an old friend, an aunt or something, how Oprah just gets you to open up and be vulnerable. And nobody really has possessed that.
And she was able to get everyone on the show, everyone from presidential candidates to, I don't know, first time actors. It's everyone came on the show.
I would say the closest I would have seen would have been Jada Pinkett Smith with her Red Table Talk, because she was just so open and vulnerable too. But she's another one who's a little bit too open about certain things. And then with the slap that was heard around the world, it kind of soured some people off of Jada. So other than that, there is no other Oprah. Like, Oprah, that's just a staple that we won't see again.
Who's watching daytime talk shows these days, now that more people are working from home? Is there a different audience?
I feel as though you do have a little bit of a brand new audience. You do have some millennials that are working from home, some people who are catching up on talk shows who used to watch daytime talk shows. They're getting reacquainted with talk shows because the landscape has really changed. Your favorites aren't there anymore. You have the Drew Barrymores, you have the Kelly Clarksons, The View. The View is the only thing that I feel as though is still a long time staple that has people having something comforting. Like, but it's a whole new different audience now, and they're just daytime talk shows are trying their best to catch that audience.
How many watch daytime talk show versus the cable news shows during the day? Do you know?
Ooh, cable news gets millions and millions. Mm-hmm. Daytime talk shows, they still get millions, but not as like the cable shows, because at least people are home when they're able to watch those. Nobody's at home, or not a lot of people are at home to watch daytime shows versus they are with cable news.
So there are new faces on cable news shows. There's Simone Sanders, who used to be with the Bernie Sanders campaign. There's Jen Psaki. She's going to have a show on MSNBC.
Yes.
And so what's the buzz around those two women?
Well, Simone, from what I'm gathering, you know, she was over in the White House on Vice President Kamala Harris's team. They said the ratings aren't that pretty good for her, but she's new, so it's kind of a wait and see. Everybody's interested in seeing what Jen Psaki has to say. That's, again, she translates well with press conferences. Will she be able to turn that around on a talk show? The person that comes to mind with that didn't translate well was Megyn Kelly. Megyn Kelly, NBC brought her from cable news, and they thought that she was going to translate in the talk show arena, and she failed and bombed miserably.
And where is she now?
She is, I think the last thing I saw was she was doing things on YouTube. She has a show that she publishes on YouTube.
I guess everything can end up on YouTube.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much.
All right. Jillian, thank you so much.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Jillian Bowe, senior editor of DaytimeConfidential.com. Coming up, hashtag convent life, why nuns are taking to TikTok. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, first there was hashtag van life, a viral hashtag dedicated to living life in a van. Now, another lifestyle hashtag is gaining some traction, hashtag convent life.
So today we're going to talk about nun pockets. Anybody who went to Catholic school or hung out with nuns or hangs out with nuns who wear a traditional habit knows that we have special pockets. They are humongous. We have two pockets that are about this big.
That's right. Nuns are turning to TikTok, giving users a peek into, well, their lives in a convent. They have racked up thousands of followers with their dancing, their cooking, their knitting, and their religious rituals. Anna Furman has been following their TikTok posts, and she wrote about it for the New York Times. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Well, why is it that nuns like TikTok, or these nuns like TikTok?
I think they want to demystify what they do and who they are and to spread their message.
Oh, their message of what? That this is the way to be, or to attract more people into the convent life, or at least into religious life?
When I spoke to a number of sisters, they just had the message that Jesus loves you and that there is a path that he has set up for followers.
Oh, and are these younger nuns that are primarily doing
this? Sort of a mix. I spoke to one nun who is in her 50s, a sister who's in her 30s. There's multiple generations on TikTok.
Tell us about the nun we just heard, Sister Monica Claire, and she was talking about her nun pockets. Tell us more about her.
She's Episcopal, and she grew up, you know, in rural Georgia, Southern Baptist, but fairly secular, was married for a few years, and then she felt like something was missing in her life. So she started writing letters, like pen to paper letters, not emails, to people in religious communities, and she found a sense of belonging.
And this is an Episcopalian order?
Yes.
But these TikTok nuns are from all orders, right? All versions of Christianity?
I also spoke to sisters who are part of Roman Catholic orders, one of which is in Boston. It's called Daughters of St. Peter, and it's very conservative, and it's an international community.
And do they have different messages if they're more conservative?
They keep the TikToks pretty light. Sometimes there'll be scripture that's quoted, but more often than not, it's dance videos, it's lip syncing, it's dribbling basketballs, the lighter variety of video.
Which is funny, right? I mean, it's funny to see a nun dribbling a basketball, let's be honest.
Yeah, it's very funny.
And so I guess they're playing on that. They know that it's a little, I don't know, profane for a nun to be playing basketball when we think they should be inside praying all the time.
The nuns I spoke to are all very self-aware and are very, you know, have gained more than 100,000 followers, each of them. So they're aware that their follower base is delighted and surprised by seeing nuns on lawnmowers and dribbling basketballs and dancing.
What is the attraction for us? Why are these posts being viewed by so many people?
Convents, up until fairly recently, were secluded communities and not necessarily accessible to people who are non-religious like me. And also a lot of their videos kind of hit a funny bone, or, you know, they kind of tickle your brain a little bit.
Yeah. Do they ever do tutorials?
There's one tutorial that Sister Monica Claire did that is her skincare routine, which is basically stay inside. And if you are going outside, wear SPF.
Right.
That's it.
Practical. Stripped down, if you will.
Exactly.
What is the reaction on the part of their superiors? Are they okay with this?
I think it really ranges. For Sister Monica Claire, she's the sister superior in her community, and they're very progressive, whereas other communities are more rigid. So Daughters of St. Peter in Boston has a marketing department, and any, you know, requests for interviews go from the top down. So it sort of varies.
But is there anything particularly irreligious about doing something like this, being on TikTok, which can be pretty raunchy in certain circumstances? I'm not saying the nuns are raunchy, but the platform can be raunchy. Does anyone frown upon that?
One woman I spoke to, Sister Lisa, was scouted by a casting producer in Los Angeles to participate in a kind of game show where she would lip sync on stage. And she wanted to participate, but she felt conflicted, and her superiors at the time decided against it because it would require a lot of time away from her community and her responsibilities. And one person told me it sounded gimmicky. So I think within the more traditional Roman Catholic orders, there is a bit more of a reticence to embrace all forms of TikTok, and there's more of a narrow lane that they post videos in.
Well, I guess if the point is to demystify and to maybe attract more people into the fold, is it working? Is there any way to measure that?
Yeah, it sounds like a number of their followers have reached out, not only with questions about joining communities, but there was a couple women who visited Sister Monica Claire's community in New Jersey that learned about her online.
So she's kind of a celebrity now.
She totally is.
Is she okay with that?
She's both excited to, you know, be in touch with so many people around the world and have sort of exchanges with them online, and at the same time she does get a lot of requests for, you know, specific questions, people having conflicts in their lives, and she's only one person and is a very busy person who doesn't have time to respond to every commenter.
Right. And I guess it does take away from her, well, her chosen path, which is to be in service of God in pretty much and pray and spend a lot of time in prayer.
Right. Yeah. The schedules that each of the women I talk to are very structured, and some of them are praying, you know, 10 times a day they're going to the chapel.
Wow. So there's only so much TikToking you can do if you need to be in chapel.
Right.
All right. Well, Anna, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. That's Anna Furman, freelance reporter for the New York Times, where she wrote about the nuns of TikTok. And before we go, just a reminder, it is Election Day. If you're in LA, you have the opportunity to vote for who you want to be the next mayor of Los Angeles. The top two vote getters will move on to November's general election. But if one candidate wins more than 50%, well, that is it. There's also a chance to vote for LA County Sheriff. There are House seats, a Senate seat. It goes all the way up to governor. So you can vote in person at your local vote center, and you can check your mail-in ballot for your assigned location, or you can fill out and submit that mail-in ballot, and ballots sent by mail must be postmarked by today to be counted in this primary. We'll have the results tomorrow right here on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Happy voting. I'll see you tomorrow.